This is Stephen Downs here in Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada, and I'm just about to jump into the hangout with Barry Dahl. I haven't joined in yet, but now I'm just clicking join this hangout, and we'll see if everything works. Should be recording on Audacity. Broadcasting on Ed Radio, clicking join, and I appear to be on air with Barry Dahl. Hi, Barry. And he's not speaking yet. And I'm not getting audio from him. You seem to be transmitting audio. Barry, nod if you can hear me. So we'll just turn down the music because that may be confusing people.
Let me try again.
Oh, that works much better.
No.
Hi, Barry. I hear you.
Huh.
I hear you. Do you hear me? Oh, and now he's gone silent again. Oh, but he nodded. That means he hears me. But I've lost his audio. Oh, but I'm hearing an echo of my voice.
All right. And of course, I had a set of headphones with me that I lost. Are you able to hear me now, Stephen?
I hear you just fine.
Okay, well, good. I had headphones with me here in San Diego for Fusion, and I must have walked away from it at some point. So I'm hoping that it'll work all right with my speakers and microphone built in.
We're getting a bit of an echo, but it's not too bad at the moment.
It's gone away on my end, but that doesn't mean it's gone away completely.
Yeah, exactly. No, it seems to be all right here right now. And just so you know, I'm recording on Audacity, and that's picking up okay. And I'm also broadcasting on Ed Radio, and that seems to be going out okay. To my usual Ed Radio audience of zero people.
Yeah. All right. Well, I wouldn't be surprised if we get a few people just drop in and join us in the hangout, but so far they haven't done so.
No. Well, I think they're waiting for a URL.
Well, I sent it out on Twitter, and of course it's posted on Google+, and that was kind of all I was planning to do. So.
All right. Well, I haven't seen it yet. I just came to your Google+ page and watched it.
Oh, and you don't see it?
I'm just opening Twitter now.
Okay.
So I'm not one of those people who has Twitter open all the time. Here we go. I see. Let me just copy that link location and I'll tweet that.
That'd be great. Yeah, that got a little wild.
That's wild.
So I wonder what why that comes and goes. What's causing that?
I think it has to do with volume. I think if I anything as loud will be enough to just sort of cross that threshold and create an echo. That was pretty good,
right? Well, I cut down the volume on my speakers. I don't think that should affect the volume of my microphone. So can you still hear me all right?
Yeah. Yeah, I hear you fine.
Okay. Why don't we give it another minute or two, and we'll just get started since it's going to be recorded anyway. We'll not waste any more of your time, and we'll have the interview, and we'll see if we get some people to chime in whenever they have a chance.
All right. Now, are you using the Google Hangout broadcasting thing?
Yes.
Okay, excellent. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I am, and I do think that's it's not quite as smooth as just a regular Google Hangout, which in my experience has been extremely great audio and video, and I think that it is the broadcasting piece that makes this a little bit dicier.
Yeah.
Which is totally understandable, of course.
Yeah. All right. Trying to do something else.
Well, I'll tell you what. How about if we just get going, and I'm gonna let you do most of the talking. Of course, I'll chime in if I feel I need to, and of course try to get some of the questions asked. But I'll start by just letting you know that I'm still here in San Diego for Desire to Learn Fusion 2012. The main conference was Monday through Wednesday, and it was the biggest and best. We had over 1,000 people in attendance overall, and it was a success. We're now in the post conference workshops, which hands on workshops both Thursday and today, Friday, and so it's been quite an experience. I know you've been to Fusion before. It would have been nice to have you here, but this is one reason we're doing the online thing, is so we can kind of bring you into Fusion somehow or another.
Yeah, I have been to a few Fusion conferences in the past. The St. Paul conference was one of them, and the one in Memphis. In Duluth.
That's right.
Duluth.
Yeah, when we hosted in Duluth, I still have a couple of photos of you at the aquarium there, the Great Lakes Aquarium in Duluth, as well as some of the other events. All right, so Stephen, I think that the topic is kind of the topic du jour is all about MOOCs. So I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about MOOCs and exactly what is a MOOC, or how do you define a MOOC, and I see a lot of talk, and almost I would maybe use the word hype surrounding the concept of MOOCs. So I'm also kind of curious as to whether some of the things you see people talking about MOOCs, does that even fit your definition of what one is? So give us a basic grounding in the concept of a MOOC, please.
Yeah. I'm not really one for definitions. That's the first thing to keep in mind. That's really important. So, but okay. We have the term MOOC, Massive Open Online Course. On the online part, I think is pretty evident. I think they do have to be online, at least a significant proportion of them. The whole concept of being online is that they're accessible to people no matter where they happen to be, South America, Europe, Africa, wherever. You can't really have a MOOC where everybody has to go to your campus in St. Louis. It just doesn't work. Open, I think, is a really important aspect of a MOOC. A lot of people argue about what constitutes open exactly, and I saw some discussion on the OERU website or mailing list recently saying, well, can we have our open resources and charge for them? And there's a big sentiment for defining open as being able to be charged. And which one is it? It's the Udemy MOOCs are charging for their courses. I don't see how you can call something open and charge money for it. I'm sorry. Those two concepts to me just don't go together in the same sentence. The massive part is the part that has the most contention and the part that's the most interesting. And of course, people really focused on the massive bit of the Coursera MOOCs, the Stanford MOOCs, the Udemy MOOCs, and so on. And even the ones that George Siemens and I did, what really caught people's eye was that we were offering our course to thousands of people at once. And there is something to that, but, people have offered MOOCs that have turned out to be small. I called one of them a MEEC, a mini educational experience class, spelled with a K, or you can call them a MITE, mini instructional technology experience. But these actually still qualify as MOOCs because The way I look at it, what makes something a MOOC is not the number of people who actually join it. It's rather the system or the course is set up in such a way that a large number of people could join it if they wanted. So what that means is that there are design elements here that avoid bottlenecks. The classic bottleneck is your typical online discussion list. Works well with 20 people, 40 people, even 100 people, but your typical discussion, like an online list, a threaded discussion list, does not work well with 100,000 people. It just gets overwhelmed. You even see that, you read a newspaper article in the Globe and Mail or something, you go to see the comments, you have 467 comments. This is a system that's not working. Nobody's reading all those comments. There's really not an incentive there to actually add number 468. So I think that's an important aspect. The last bit, course, is sort of interesting because, I've never really thought of what I do as offering courses online. And it's funny, all of the elements of the MOOC are in place ahead of time in things like my online newsletter. So the only thing that changed between the newsletter and the MOOC, because we even used the same software, was the fact that there was a start date, there was an end date, there were things in between, like regularly scheduled events. There was sort of like a course objective. It had some of the trappings of a course. I resisted that a lot at first, but, I think of a MOOC, again, and a MOOC in this potentially massive scenario as being designed like a network. And it's this network structure that makes it potentially massive, because instead of having a one-to-many or a one-to-mass kind of a relationship here, you have a whole bunch of one-to-one, small group-to-small group kind of interactions. And so you can scale it that way. And what I found is, over time, you can develop these networks, these online communities of people. But what a MOOC does is it creates a start and an end point. And it's kind of like shaking up the network, right? Because when you set up a MOOC, you have a whole bunch of new people that you've never met before coming in and joining your network. And you're with them for a while, and then they go off and do their own thing. And that was exactly the experience I had with these MOOCs. There's a bunch of people I could name them. I won't name them because I don't want to single them out. But there's a bunch of people I could name very specifically. Oh, yeah, I ran into you because of these MOOCs. I ran into you because of this MOOC. I ran into you because of that MOOC. So there is a value to this start and end point. Not so much the fact that it's a course, but the fact that it shakes up the network. And shaking up the network is a good and a valuable thing to do.
Well, yeah, that sounds great, Stephen. I just want to get your opinion, make sure that I'm not totally off base on something. The opening keynote speaker at Fusion this year was Sal Khan. I know that you know all about the Khan Academy.
Yeah.
But I saw within the last week, and I think it was Inside Higher Ed. I'd have to look for the source, but I saw an article about MOOCs, and as they were listing some of the MOOCs, they included the Khan Academy as a MOOC, which struck me as a very odd idea. What's your take on that?
Well, yeah, now they're beginning to list anything that has lots of people that go to it as a MOOC. So, next week they'll be calling the Oscars a MOOC because lots of people watched it on TV, which would be pretty ridiculous. The Khan Academy starts off with a bunch of videos, and they're pretty low tech, and there's a lot of them, and they're widely viewed. What they've tried to do since then is to build kind of educational trappings and a social network around those videos. And it's a part of Khan Academy that doesn't really get talked a lot about. It's the part of Khan Academy that the Gates money is supposed to be funding. Because Bill Gates isn't funding Sal Khan to make more videos. he's funding Khan to try to create this educational infrastructure around Khan Academy. And if that works, and it really depends on how it all comes out looking in the end, right? I don't know how it's going to all look in the end, then there's a potential for Khan Academy to be a MOOC. Or a MOOC-like structure, because, you know, then Khan Academy is almost like my newsletter, right? It's this ongoing thing with a whole bunch of educational resources, but there isn't the start date, the end date, etc. Sorry, I'm watching. Hang on, you got to see this. They're knocking down trees outside my office.
And, oh, no.
Yeah, it's awful. And I don't know why my camera went. There we go, that's better. So as I'm talking to you, I'm watching this process unfold, and it's just killing me that they're doing this. I just hate it. So you can see it.
Wow.
Maybe even there it goes. Or not yet. And it's the weirdest process they're using. They're not cutting them down. They just use a backhoe and knock them over. It's so sad. And like, it's just, it kills me. Anyhow. So.
Wow.
So there we go. I'm broadcasting the destruction of trees worldwide. It's just my forest. They're killing my forest. It's a thing is, that's what I've been looking out at outside my window for years, and now it's gone, or in the process of being wiped out. There's more behind it, but still. Anyhow, so, you know, it's a MOOC-like, Khan Academy is MOOC-like, but yeah, I wouldn't agree that it's a MOOC.
Yeah. So, talk to me a little bit about how the constructivist approach, the constructivist philosophy, plays into a MOOC, and I guess I'm kind of interested is can you really have a MOOC that doesn't have at least some of the basic principles of constructivist theory involved?
Well, sure. It just has to be a network, right? If you have a non-constructivist network, you're fine. I mean, all you need for a network is signals being sent back and forth between the members. There's an awful lot of overhead and trappings to constructivism that don't need to be there. And it's almost ironic. We had criticisms in some of the MOOCs that we offered by people who were constructivists saying, look, you're not supporting the construction of knowledge here. It's like, you know, you're too much like lectures and all of that. And my response was, well, look, we're not constructivists. You know, we don't have to do that. You know, there's elements of constructivism that I really like, and you know, and it's the elements that have to do with active participatory. There goes another tree. Active participatory learning on the part of the students. But I think the argument for that is different from the argument for a MOOC. The argument for a MOOC is, you set up learning in such a way as to foster communication between the participants in a large network, and your teacher is one of those participants. And then constructivism talks about the nature of those communications, the content of those communications, the intent behind them. Constructivism involves a lot more leading on the part of an instructor than a typical MOOC might entail. You know, it involves a much more direct involvement in the learning process by the instructor than a typical MOOC might entail. So there's no requirement for a MOOC to be constructivist.
So you've been involved with MOOCs, and you're going to be involved with more. Then a lot of the news lately is surrounding the organizations like Udemy and Udacity, Coursera, edX, et cetera, et cetera. How do the MOOCs that you have been and will continue to be involved with, how do they differ from the offerings of those other entities?
Oh, they're smaller and they're a lot less commercial. yeah, we don't have a business model. We don't have millions of dollars of funding. I forget what it is. Was it Coursera got 16 and Udemy 40 million or something? We don't have that. So we've been pretty low tech. But, you know, we are much more conversational. We are deliberately structured as a network. We haven't emphasized, you know, the high profile names of the instructors because our instructors don't have high profile names. So, you know, there's that aspect as well. Our MOOCs are, if you will, more democratic. They're more community based. And the objective is different. We're not trying to get people to learn a certain body of content. You look at these other MOOCs, the Udemy, Coursera, and that, they're content focused, right? And the professor will come along and present some content, and then you do some stuff to show that you've learned that content. That's not what we're up to in a connectivist MOOC. We're not up to having people learn content. We're up to having people work with content, read content, produce content, but not some particular content. It could be any content. We have way too much content in one of our MOOCs, and people pick and choose. That's, you know, in the other MOOCs, everybody's following along pretty much the same content. In our MOOCs, we have 2,200 people. We have 2,200 different content packages. You know, each person is looking at their own thing. In our MOOCs, the knowledge comes from the interactions between people, where people from these different perspectives compare notes. That doesn't happen in the other MOOCs. The other MOOCs could exist perfectly fine without this conversation communication taking place. And that's why, in a certain sense, they're not really different from the Academy Awards, right? So
right.
I think it's this different objective, this different understanding of what knowledge is and how it's produced and how learning results from interaction that creates a very different shape and form in our MOOCs from those MOOCs.
You know, Stephen, one thing I find kind of fascinating is that many of the elite organizations, higher ed I'm talking about in particular, mm-hmm. have been very reluctant to get involved in online learning. They, almost to the, you know, well, just a minimal extent over the last, say, 15 years of development. Much of that development, of course, was happening at community colleges and for-profits and that sort of thing. And now they're jumping in with both feet to the MOOC concept. So I guess part of my question is why now, and what's in it for them from the MOOC concept that they really haven't been interested in playing in the same area, at least online education, in what you might call a more traditional sense of online education, knowing that the tradition is not that long. But why are they jumping in now?
Well, one of the things that MOOCs show, the ones we did especially show, is that the bottom is about the fallout of the traditional model. And I mean that almost literally. If you can educate several thousand people online in such a way that these people feel like they've obtained something of value from what you've done, you've seriously undermined the business model of a traditional education. What we showed is it could be done. What the Stanford project, the AI course, showed is it could be done on a really, really, really massive basis. You know, all of a sudden, we're not looking at the need for, you know, several thousand educational institutions anymore. If one institution can offer a course for 100,000 people, you don't need 100 institutions offering a course for 100 people. You just don't need it anymore. So what do the elites do is they try to get out in front of this, right? Because if there's going to be a shakedown, and there may well be, there'll be much fewer institutions left over, and they want to be among them. And they want to be the ones offering these courses for 100,000 people. and they can take advantage of their name and their reputation in order to put themselves into that position. You see, before now, there was no upside to them going online. Everybody was going online. Everybody had an online course. Everybody had a learning management system. Why would they do that? Everybody else is doing it. But as soon as you have a situation where only the top X number of institutions would be able to do it, then you have something that is very attractive to them. And I think that's what they're thinking. I think that's what they're thinking.
Right. So that sounds a bit like doom and gloom for the community colleges and for-profits and those that have been developing the small-scale online ed. So I guess two questions. One is, how do they survive it? Is there really any question they will survive it? But how would they survive that? Or are they going to try to find their own niche in the MOOC world? Or as you say, is it just a case that we're going to need a lot fewer institutions as we look further down the road into the future?
All of the above. There's no inherent need for them to survive, right? The world existed for a very long time before community colleges. It'll exist for a very long time after them. And really the only question is when those beginning and end points are. That's not to say that they don't do something that's really important and valuable. I mean, I spent time working in community college. I know what they do. And I know the value of it. But, you know, right from the very beginning of my involvement with online learning, I've tried to give the message to traditional institutions like community colleges, like your average university, that you have to change your model here. That, you know, if you're working with online learning, it's not just business as usual the way it's always been. And that's what they're going to have to do. They're going to have to become a lot more community focused, I would say. They're going to have to open up a lot more. They're going to have to collaborate a lot better. I mean, one of the things that George and I discovered working with a MOOC is you can have one MOOC with two institutions. Same course, two separate institutions. Why not? You have exactly the same content, same instructors, same people. There's different local services that each institution is providing. One example of that is the assessment and the evaluation. And so somebody joins our MOOC from, say, Israel. They get credit at an Israeli institution. And they do, you know, they evaluate the person's learning artifacts or essays or whatever it is that they produce to say, yes, so-and-so has done this MOOC and performed to our satisfaction. We'll certify them. And that works perfectly fine. And it's that kind of collaboration and cooperation between institutions that's going to have to happen now. How do institutions survive? Well, right now, these institutions are teaching a small percentage of the world population. The way they survive is they teach a much larger percentage of the world population. The way they survive is to get a lot better at what they do. The way they survive is to open up the processes, open up their classes, open up their learning materials, invite everybody in, work toward the social good. And then when all of the people are there in that place, that's where there's room for, to use the cliched word, monetization. You sell value-added services, you sell location-specific services, or you receive funding from local institutions, local governments to support certain kind of content, certain kind of learning materials. You know, there's all kinds of ways in which these institutions are sustainable, but the model of we sell education for money, that's not one of them anymore.
At least
I hope not.
Yeah, Stephen, as we get ready to wrap up here, tell us a little bit about the MOOC that you'll be involved with George Siemens. Desire to Learn is one of the sponsors there, along with EDUCAUSE, the Chronicle of Education, Higher Education, quite a few sponsors. It's called the Current and Future State of Higher Education. By the way, the website is edfuture.net. But tell us what people can expect if they get involved in that particular MOOC.
Well, unlike Change 11, which spanned over 6 months, this one will be 6 weeks. So it's going to be a lot shorter and sharper. One of the things we learned with the Change MOOC is you can do one of these things for too long. We're all exhausted by the end of it. This time we'll be seeing if we can do it too quickly. It's going to be more intense. There will be, as I recall, 3 sessions during each week. Each week, of course, as before, we'll have guests in different areas. Because we have so many sponsors, the content won't be so predictable. It used to be George and I are teaching course, so you can pretty much tell what they're going to talk about. But now we'll get a lot more perspectives and points of view. I think that'll be interesting. The number of people may be larger because, again, of the sponsorship. That may produce some dynamics. And on a more personal note, it won't be using Grasshopper. It'll be using somebody else's interpretation of what Grasshopper does. That'll be interesting to me to see how someone else approaches the same problems I've been approaching. Because one of the differences between our MOOCs and the other MOOCs, right, is Grasshopper, is, the idea that people work in their own environment and their own belonging space or whatever, and we create a network out of that. So that's not the simplest thing in the world to do. Udemy and Coursera and that, they didn't even try. In this case, I think D2L is going to try, and it would be really interesting to see how that comes out.
Right. In closing, I want to correct myself, because I totally blew one of my earlier questions by asking about constructivism, when of course I meant connectivism, and I'd at least like to thank you for not pounding on me too hardly for that slip, and you handled the answer to it very well, so I do appreciate that. And I see Audrey Williams on there. Audrey, do you have any question or comment for Stephen?
I don't think so. I'm sorry I got here kind of late, but I just was curious to see if you, I don't know, did you guys talk a little bit about the MOOC within a D2L environment? I mean, utilizing, so I'm interested to see if you're going to use Grasshopper within the learning environment. So I may have missed that. I can watch the recording. And
yeah, well, Stephen just touched on that right near the end, and quite frankly, I think we're all kind of interested in how that all is going to work. And so we are going to be taking the learning environment to open it up, as the openness is an incredibly important piece of the MOOC concept. And so it's both how we open up the learning environment that is in progress right now, so we can figure out how that will work best, and then how to integrate Stephen's Grasshopper, both software/concept, to aggregate the learning of the potentially thousands and thousands of participants in this particular course. So that's an ongoing process, and I think we're all going to learn a lot about how that can work in just the next couple of months. The course begins in October, but the work has already begun to make it happen.
Oh, that sounds great. I think it'll be a wonderful experience, because I can see taking it from a MOOC down to a, what do we call it, a souk, within an institution, like you're saying. So because I love the idea of learning and doing where you are and in the tools you have, but then pulling it in like via Grasshopper instead of forcing someone to go into a specific tool to do that creation. So yay.
Yeah, that's what I'd like to see out of D2L and any learning management system, is this capacity to extend beyond its own borders, to bring content in and also to send content out. I mean,
right.
We talk about how institutions survive. The way institutions are going to survive is their learning environments are going to be open in just this way, and that's how they're going to survive. And it'll be interesting I mean, people will understand much better what these institutions do when they can just log on to a class and watch what they do. And I think we'll have a really different appreciation for the role higher education or education of any sort plays in our society. There's an awful lot of, you know, people sort of can stand there off in the sidelines and say, well, they're not doing this and they're not doing that. And who can prove them wrong? Right? Because
right.
most of what happens in education happens inside those walls. Once this is opened up, once people can see, participate, and benefit from that process, the value of the public investment in these institutions becomes a lot more apparent. And I think will be supported by a much wider community as a result.
That's great. Well, thanks. On that note, I think we'll wrap up. All three of us, I'm sure, have busy days, and we'll get back to it. I'll go ahead and end the broadcast, and hopefully everything will work well on the recording end, and we'll be able to post this for anybody else who might have an interest. So, Audrey, thanks for joining us. But, Stephen, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. And we should do this again sometime.
I'd love to.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot. I'm going to end it now. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye, everyone. And this is Stephen Downs. For those of you who may be listening on Ed Radio still, we're just signing off now. And we'll go back to our regularly unscheduled broadcast. And I am pleased to report that we do not have zero listeners. we have one listener. So it looks like maybe Cordoba or... It's definitely Argentina, and we'll just narrow it down a bit. No, it's north of Rosario, so it's up the river there, a place I've not been, so maybe if I ever get down Argentina way again, I can come out there. But nice to have you with us, and until next time, this is Stephen Downs signing off. So